Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. It's a week since the Biden administration released its $715 billion 2022 budget request to Congress, and today marks the 32nd anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, which is interestingly being marked by nations across the region, rallying not only toward one another, but toward the United States as they build their future defense plans. We hosted deep budget dives into the Navy with Brian McGrath and our very own contributing editor, Chris Cavas, and the United States Air Force with Air Force Magazine's John Turpak and Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we will be looking next week into the Army budget with Dr. Stacey Pettyjohn of CNAS and Andrew Hunter of CSIS. Joining us today is our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond, including Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Dr. Patrick Cronin, who directs the Asia program at the Hudson Institute think tank, former Pentagon comptroller Bob Hale, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many roles is a senior advisor at CSIS. Everybody, thanks very much again for joining us.
Be back, Vago.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Vago.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. Okay, guys, it's been a week since the budget was released. And unlike last week, when we were talking on the fly, literally as the budget was being rolled out, we've all had an opportunity to assess what the administration wants to do. While expectations were running very, very high that this was going to be a big needle-moving budget, the administration, in fairness, repeatedly stressed that this was going to be an interim budget and that 2023 would be really the big year for change. A senior official also told me the reason they took as long as they did is they wanted to meticulously go through every line of the previous administration's budget. First, not to find any Easter eggs in it. And the second thing was that they did not benefit from a normal transition, unfortunately, which set the entire process back. Ultimately, I do think the budget started moving the department toward the hard choices that have been necessary and we've all been discussing for some time. The Navy complained the loudest, but that's because it expected the biggest windfall that it didn't get. The Army, I think, avoided some hard choices, whereas the Air Force and the Marines, true to the messaging we've been getting from the chiefs of those two services, rightly decided to take risk now, acknowledging that taking risk later would be riskier and more expensive. Patrick, I want to start off with you as the regional expert, right? The administration has billed this as a budget that is aimed at China. What folks may be missing is that the administration, with a very, very small staff, in fairness, right? I mean, service secretary is not in place already in June or just starting to get in place with Christine Wormuth recently taking the chair. We're expecting Frank Kendall to be next in the Air Force. Mike McCord is thankfully in. We're going to have an announcement hopefully soon on a Navy secretary. But they have been coordinating very closely with allies and partners. Talk to us a little bit about your take on this budget, right? Is this the right budget if you're trying to transition the country to do a better job at deterring not just the country, but to support its allies to countering China? And how is it being synced with what's happening with our allies and partners across the Pacific Rim?
Well, Vago, when I look at the defense budget, I'm looking at it in the context of our global strategy. So I think the administration is getting a lot right, and I think this budget moves in the right direction. It's investing at home, and so it's investing heavily in research and development because we're trying to compete in the long term in a very big technological race with China and other countries. It's very much centered on working with allies and partners. And so when I think about the missile focus, in our current budget, that very much syncs up with what I see in the Australian defense budget, including advancing hypersonic missiles, but also the scrapping of the ballistic missile guidelines with South Korea, working with Japan to talk about the need for enhanced deterrence and even strike capability. All of those are related to our strategy. And so this budget is not just about numbers. It really is working hand in glove with the diplomacy. And its focus, I think, thirdly, on more vital interests. So, yes, it is more focused on China. It's not ignoring Russia. And it's trying to keep American commitments to what is necessary around the world. And that means making hard choices, whether it's Afghanistan and the Middle East, or differentiating on where we compete with China. So I see this budget from the lens of the strategy that is being pursued at the White House and inside the administration. And I like what I see so far.
Byron, let me bring you into the discussion. Unfortunately, you couldn't join us last week, but you've written extensively and thoughtfully on elements of the budget and the industrial implications of some of what's been going on. Right, for reformers, it didn't move the needle enough. For some, it moved the wrong needles in the wrong places. Dove has a piece out in The Hill today that, you know, and one of the things, elements that we did discuss last week was that the White House, even in its own statement on the budget, didn't mention defense, thereby degrading it as a priority in the eyes of perhaps our adversaries and our allies. And Dove, I'll give you an opportunity to make that case in a moment. Byron, why don't you take it away?
Look, I think, you know, you guys called it last week. The standout to me was the increase in research, development, test, evaluation over procurement, over the FYDP. You know, there were numbers disclosed by OMB on this, even though, of course, as everybody knows, we didn't get the detailed budget justification books. So you really don't know exactly how some of those changes were made in FY23 through FY26. I think back to maybe some of Patrick's points, you know, it's an interesting dilemma that I think the country faces, which is if you are in great power competition, you know, you want to make sure that you have enough in the R&D pipeline. So you're kind of constantly trying to stay a step ahead of what your adversaries are investing in. But at the same time, you've got to make sure that the current force is capable of deterring and has enough overmatch to prevail in the, you know, quote unquote, fight tonight. So that standout feature of, wow, we didn't really buy a lot of new platforms in this budget, at least over the five-year plan as suggested by the procurement numbers and the cuts to procurement. The ratio of RDT&E to procurement, it remains at kind of record low levels. If you go back to 1955, it's around 1.2. It tends to surge during conflict. And obviously the other outlier is the Reagan buildup and the surge in procurement at that particular point in time. But I think there's a balance here that it's going to be interesting next week as both the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And Kath Hicks is going to be speaking at a CNAS event as well. So kind of fleshing out and explaining exactly what some of the choices were made, you know, I think will be helpful here. I'll say the kind of market reaction, the industry reaction to this budget has been marginally positive. I still think there were some unfounded fears about how deep some of these cuts could fall. We had the 715 number, but I think there's a fascinating irony here that if you look at the 10-year plan the Biden administration proposed for defense spending, it's higher than the Trump plan.
Bob and Dove, Bob, why don't you start us off, right? You guys have had a week to ruminate over the budget. Bob, start us off. What are some of the things that you've noticed, you know, that you either like or don't like?
Thanks, Vago. I'll start with a new program, the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, that was partly started at congressional request last year, but the administration has supported it. But they put $5.1 billion toward that program, a lot of money. Almost all of it is in procurement, something like 97%. And it is already being sharply criticized because there are some items in there like a DDG and some F-35s that people are saying, well, you would have bought those anyway, you just put them in there. But it certainly shows a commitment, whatever mix Congress ends up allocating to it, it certainly shows consistent with the China emphasis in this budget. Interestingly, the European initiative, which is a deterrence initiative, is a lot older. It was started back when I was in the comptroller around 2015, I think, 2016. Came down. It was $4.5 billion in fiscal 21. The request is for $3.7 billion, almost a 20% cut. And the administration has said they are, quote, trending toward a steady state in that budget. So despite Russia's being on the Ukraine border. I'm a little surprised that that European deterrence initiative has come down. I'll make one other comment that I think is consistent with China emphasis, and that's where what they're doing in the R&D, RDT&E budget. It's up about 5%, a record level in terms of dollars being requested for RDT&E, but it's interesting to see where they're putting their bets. They actually cut basic and applied research funding. That kind of surprised me. If we're going to beat China with innovation, I would have thought we'd be buying more for the long run. But they greatly increased by almost 12% the money that goes toward advanced component development and prototypes. So they're doing, I think, what Austin said he wanted to do. They not just develop technology, but actually field it. And when you look at some of the specifics, hypersonics is the clear winner here, up by 19% compared to fiscal 21, and a statement that they will field hypersonic weapons in the FYDP, which would be truly remarkable if they're able to meet that goal. Also increases in cybersecurity and artificial intelligence. But hypersonics seems to be a key, again, I think, consistent with the approach toward deterring China.
Dov, you are both in some ways enthusiastic and in other ways somewhat less than enthusiastic, as your piece today in The Hill suggests. And I commend to the audience to check out America's Allies and Enemies Will Take Note of Biden's Low Priority Defense Budget. Talk to us about your concerns and how some of them have only been accentuated over the past week.
Well, let me pick up where Bob Hale just left off, because I do write about the science and technology budget declining by about 13%. And as Bob says, this is extremely puzzling. I mean, let's face it, when we're spending money on hypersonics, we're essentially playing catch-up ball because the Chinese and the Russians already have them. We don't. Obviously, we've got to spend a ton of money to catch up. But if we want to stay ahead and really hit cutting edge technologies, then we should be spending money on the what they call 6.1, 6.2, 6.3A, which translates into English as basic research. And then you've got advanced technology development and finally the first stages of engineering development. Those are the areas that if you really want to stay ahead, you've got to spend money on those. And so I'm puzzled by that particular cut. Bob's right, obviously, that we're spending money on that Pacific Deterrence Initiative. But the administration has also said that, of course, there's a lot more money that they have that they're spending beyond that $5.1 billion on what they call, you know, flexible systems. The trouble with flexible systems, and that really goes to the F-35s as well in the Pacific Initiative, is that they won't necessarily be in the Pacific. And as evidence of that, the Ronald Reagan is going to be moving out of Western Pacific and in support of the withdrawal of Afghanistan. And there's not even going to be a carrier in the Western Pacific. So that tells you that, you know, if something else comes up, say the Russians try to do something against Ukraine again, and at that point, China does something in the South China Sea, we're going to be caught in the middle. And that brings me to another issue, which is the Navy cut. Now, the Navy expected a lot more, but, you know, realistically, just look at what they got the last couple of years. 2 years ago, they got 10 ships. Last year, they got 11 ships. And then after all this talk about how the Navy is going to expand to 450 ships or 500 or whatever the number is, they come up with only 8 ships. That's a problem too. And then finally, I just should mention on hypersonics, the Army actually cut its long-range hypersonic program. And since the Army is talking about long-range fires, that too is a very puzzling development. So there's a bunch of inconsistencies here. I think Patrick is right. We have tried to work more closely with the allies than in the past. And I think that's a very, very important and good thing. But there are just elements in this budget that make me scratch my head a little bit.
Well, I would say that from an administration perspective, right? I mean, the sense was we have a carrier, we're withdrawing from Afghanistan. God forbid something happens for lack of sufficient air power or cover. A legitimate question is going to be, well, why didn't you back it up with more air power? And that's why they moved the carrier there, which is going to be playing a key role in the pullout. And there is this sense that the Chinese are not going to invade Taiwan, you know, in the month where we're in the final throes of withdrawal. And part of the challenge was, whether or not you're going to double pump some of these carriers, right? And that causes a whole series of other challenges.
Yeah, but that's not really, Vago, that's not my point. My point is that when you talk about flexibility and saying I've got more than just the 5.1 billion, you've got to recognize the reality that, of course, what's going on in support of the withdrawal makes 100% sense. And of course, the Chinese are not going to invade Taiwan at that very precise moment. I'm simply saying that when you have systems that are flexible, they may not be flexible in the Pacific because you might want them elsewhere.
Agreed. Although the counterpoint to the Navy plan and the concern that naval strategists have who have seen the plan is that the Navy's plans are actually not very good. And the Navy's answer, as we've discussed on this program repeatedly towards LCS, is, will you just rid me of it? And I never wanted to do it. I bought a lot of them and now I want to be rid of them because I really haven't figured this out. And that's not a very good answer. You're going to have 32 of these ships ultimately. And the answer isn't get rid of them before you've even deployed them. At the very time that the fleet is going, hey, you know what? These might actually be useful to me, right? I mean, it's, you've got to be a little introspective. And from the Navy's standpoint, it seems as though I want the money, just give me the money to get whatever I want to buy, as opposed to, well, you're going to have to pick and choose because ultimately you may, the right decisions may not have been made. Let me go back to Patrick here for a second to, this is the 32nd anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre. Obviously, the entire regional situation is just orders of magnitude different than it was then. Patrick, talk to us a little bit about the significance of the commemoration briefly and whether what it is that we are doing, whether it's the Pacific Defense Initiative or others, are actually as significant as they need to be given how dramatically different and more dangerous and economically and militarily powerful, diplomatically powerful, culturally powerful, right? I mean, think about it. John Cena issued an apology in Chinese because, Beijing went nuts and said that they were going to block his movie, right? Kind of an extraordinary step. Makes you not want to see that movie here in the United States, ultimately. Talk to us about that dynamic.
Well, Wago, I think the rules of the road are up for grabs in the region and in the world. And I think that's what Tiananmen sort of reminds us of, the lone tank man, one individual trying to stand up to a tank 32 years ago in Tiananmen Square is being replicated essentially in Hong Kong, where there's no right of peaceful assembly in Victory Park right now because of the suppression of the commemoration and the truth. That right to peaceful assembly is exactly the kind of human right that the United States, with like-minded allies and partners, is trying to preserve inside international rules of the road, whether it's freedom of navigation or trading or technology rules, including technologies like surveillance. China's trying to challenge those things. So when you're trying to negotiate rules of the road with a rising power like China, you're also militarily trying to deter war. And there are two challenges that are before the United States right now, working with allies. One of them is what we've seen for the last 10 years in particular, which is the increased ability for gray zone nibbling strategies from China, like in the South China Sea. And this has become a great concern about whether this produces war, right? So this was Graham Allison's Thucydides trap. Now you've got the novel by Ackerman and Jim Stavridis, 2034, talking about a South China Sea scenario blowing up into a global war. Michael O'Hanlon's new nonfiction book, The Art of War in an Age of Peace, fears also a replay of World War I in which major powers are pulled into a costly war, such as over the South China Sea, over relatively minor disputes. What we're doing here is we're trying to provide the political and military deterrence support to reassure allies and partners and pull them together in network security to ensure that China doesn't try to gain exclusive control through the PLA Navy, through the People's Armed Forces, Maritime Militia of the South China Sea, for example. We can do that, but we no longer have what Australia used to call the, you know, the 10-year early warning sort of rule. They dropped that in their own planning in the region. We no longer know whether for sure we could think out 10 years and we're not going to have a major war. We don't know that right now. And that fear is driving a lot of this budgetary pressure as well in political dispute. This is why Admiral Davidson was talking about the middle of this decade could be the period of most danger because we won't have the platforms and we won't have enough systems sort of on scene. This is what Dov Zakheim's worried about, you know, with that flexibility, if we don't have enough presence in the region and enough capability and distributed lethality, then we may not deter. But we have to remember that this is not just about money. It's about the political and diplomatic arrangements we have. So you think about the vaccines that the administration released yesterday, announced, including going to the Philippines. Well, that reassures Duterte that he doesn't have to scrap the visiting forces agreement, which may make more likely the fact that we'll be able to have geographical territory for real distributed lethality. I know I'm connecting the dots here, but those are the challenges that the defense policymakers and others in the administration are trying to make. The other big deterrent question, though, Vago, just is what Michael Hanlon talks about and is more worried about, and that's system destruction warfare, what the Chinese call system destruction warfare. That's in Oriana Schuyler-Mastro in the latest Foreign Affairs, you know, talks about the Taiwan temptation. She's worried that maybe the PLA could convince Xi Jinping, you know, that they miscalculate, that they have a moment they could have strike a knockout blow, maybe even without the use of force or very limited force, but they change the situation overnight. That's the real deterrence. That's the strategic deterrence that Michael Hanlon's talking about that we really do need to focus on and we have to take very seriously. That's going to require competition in the high-tech domain where China is trying to overtake us over the next two decades or less. And that's why the administration is trying to shift more toward research and development and less toward the immediate sort of capabilities. But there are questions, as Dov Zakheim rightly says, about the budget. I would just add there, there's also more congressional discussion about major new bills for science and technology investment and innovation. So I'm assuming right. Some of that money is going to be in other programs that eventually we have a bipartisan agreement to do what one official unnamed said in the paper. We don't want Americans to subsidize China's military industrial complex. Thank you.
Let me just very briefly, right? System destruction warfare is something that Bob Work was talking about when he was Undersecretary of the Navy, as well as when he was Deputy Secretary. And so was talking about sort of looking at how the Chinese are actually going to prosecute warfare. And I would note, and I appreciate the new Foreign Affairs article, but there are folks for the last 15 years who've been saying that the whole key is to avoid miscalculation, right? I mean, the Japanese military, starting in the mid-1920s, every single year, the political leadership turned to the military leadership and said, can we take them? Can we take them? Can we take them? And 1941 just happened to be the first year that the Imperial General Staff said, yeah, we could, this year we could take them. Okay, do it. You know, let's do it, right? So it's miscalculation. It was as stupid in 1941 as it would have been in 1945 and in 1952, right? Let me ask one quick question, and I want to get to a broader political, get back to the broader political dynamic and bring everybody else in. But do you see very briefly, if you could give me a sense, does the pullout of the Reagan suggest that the administration is not serious about China? And is the Pacific Defense Initiative sufficient, or is that the first chapter of the first part of a longer book?
It's another chapter in a long book, and the Reagan is not leaving for good. It's involved in a temporary contingency operation for safeguarding the pullout.
So you don't see that as delivering a bad message, as bad a message regionally as some critics suggest?
The bad message is this, Dov, that most Americans need to wake up to. We have limited resources. We are now dealing with a China that is as powerful as the United States in many respects and trying to overtake us in other respects. And that's the reality. And so we're going to have to face these kind of tough trade-offs whenever we do something in the coming years.
Thanks very much. Let me go to the broader trade-off question and kind of go across the piece. Is Congress going to intervene? Right, all politics are local ultimately, even though national security is collective. Ultimately, the right thing tends to happen in our system, even if it takes time, right? You can only delay an A-10 retirement by X amount, right? Once we designate something as worthy of retirement, it tends to retire. The question is what replaces it and where do you put it to sort of ameliorate political interest? Byron, start us off. Do you ultimately think that Congress is going to come back in and stop some of these retirements, especially when you're looking at it from a United States Air Force perspective, right? It's 221 airplanes. Everybody is concerned about BRAC. So airplanes going away always panics people that, oh my God, the units will go away and then they'll shut down the base that's an economic engine in my state. Talk to us a little bit, and I want to get everybody's sense on this, Bob, and then Dove. Does Congress intervene and stop these changes from happening? And ultimately, did the administration play a gambit? I get 715, I keep the peace dividend, and also everybody's unfunded lists in part or whole get funded. And so I end up with a $235 billion budget, for example. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, Congress is going to try and push back on some of this stuff. But look, you're talking about pre-block F-16s, A-10s. I mean, what's the relevance of that to a high-end conventional campaign? You know, that's the equivalent of sending Devastators to the Battle of Midway, which unfortunately happened.
And went badly.
It went very badly. Today, it's the 79th anniversary of I think it was a complete loss of all those aircraft. It was obsolescent at the time of the conflict. And I don't think that's something we want to repeat in the future. So it is a trade. And I get the jobs question. I think it's going to be very interesting. You know, talked about it before. How much time is senior DOD leadership going to invest in convincing Congress that you have to make these changes? I do think the F-15 divestment was interesting at the same time that the Air Force put a request for an additional batch of F-15 EXs in their unfunded list. And, you know, when you start thinking about, okay, that is a capability that could be delivered by 2025, 2026, if those additional aircraft are armed with hypersonic strike, okay, that makes some sense here. The DDG-51, I absolutely think that'll be added back. But I think, you know, the broader question, look, you're not in an environment where it's going to be easy to get more money for that top line. You're going to have to carve money out through the rescissions process. You're already in a major, major political debate about infrastructure and other non-defense discretionary programs. There aren't the margins in Congress to see a significant plus up in defense, much as I think the GOP members in particular are going to try for in this season. So we're still going to be working with trade-offs, and they're going to be tough. They're going to be unpleasant. You know, some of them I think are no-brainers, but as you point out, you know, there are local interests that, you know, are really put in jeopardy by some of those changes. So I expect to see some of these things roll back, but the idea that you're going to get a $735 billion budget this year, I would put very low probability on that.
I want you to take a bite at another apple, and I want to get Bob, Dove, and then Patrick's sense on this as well. There are not a lot of people in the administration right now. For, as we've heard on this program, whether from Michael Baer or Arnold Panaro or a number of other folks, including some on this panel, that the key to change is making the case for change in such way that before your national defense strategy or your national security strategy are done either later this year or early next, that you've set those foundations for change so that people understand this, right? Understand what's at stake, understand the importance of making the trade-offs. Obviously, Jack Reed is having those conversations. Adam Smith is having those conversations. They're somewhat less enthusiastic among their ranking members who would just rather see more money and make a connection to social spending. Byron, you listen to almost everything that anybody puts out in order to produce your own thoughtful work. Is the administration making as fulsome a case for change as it needs to be making now?
Well,
rather than wait later to do it.
Take a little different twist on that, which is I think you are in a period of experimentation. And the idea that you're going to go pedal to the metal with all these new innovative ideas, concepts, you really are going to have to exercise them and prove them out. And I think the Navy speaks for that. I mean, there's an idea or a concept that possibly unmanned surface combatants can help provide more force, more force structure for the Navy. But you really have to exercise that. And I think this is something where you can't impose this with civilian leadership from the top down. The people who actually use this stuff, exercise with it, maintain it, and think about how it's going to be fought in operations, really are the ones who have to be comfortable with some of these decisions. And that's ultimately where you get into the buy-in. So that's where I think this increase in research and development, test and evaluation, particularly at the 6.4 level, is an important signal that's being sent, that if we go through a 2 or 3 year period where a lot of this stuff is validated, then you kind of see that higher ground where you can get into more advanced concepts of operations that may provide a better warfighting edge. So I think we're on the right track here. I'm not as distraught maybe as others are about what this budget represents.
Bob?
So, Vago, I think the administration is hampered by the lack of confirmed political appointees. They are the ones that can help make this case on the Hill. Others will try, but I do think it's a problem. I do give the administration credit on the tough issue of early retirements. They call them divestments, I might add. And that is, they've taken what I call the cicada approach to those of us in the East who are suffering from billions of these little insects. They have proposed so many of these early retirements. I think they'll get some of them. Surely some will be turned down, but I bet they get a number, and I give them credit for trying to do something that is hard, and a number of administrations, including those I served in, tried and failed. So we'll see, but I suspect they'll get somewhere. Blanco, I would like to go back to a little broader point, and it has been quite critical of the budgets. I share some of his criticisms, but I think we should recognize this administration has had just a couple of months, really, to make try to make changes in the budget and get it started toward a different approach that's consistent with what will be their strategy. And I think in that sense, they've succeeded. I mean, clearly the PDI can question what's in it, and it'll probably get shifted some, but it's a significant commitment of money. They said that they want to actually deploy things, not just develop new ones. They put their money where their mouth is and trying to do it. They've obviously picked hypersonics as an area where they'll be first priority. So there's a lot of money in for artificial intelligence and cybersecurity as well. So I give them credit for turning this budget around somewhat toward a new strategy, and a strategy consistent with what they want to do, and doing it pretty quickly.
Dove?
Well, I'm not distraught about it. I just think that there are some inconsistencies, and there are some ways for them to fix those, or at least convey to our allies and friends, particularly in Europe, that defense really is important to this administration, in spite of what we've talked about last week and this week in terms of how they've pitch the overall budget and where defense really didn't even appear very much. And that's, there's going to be a NATO summit. And that's a huge opportunity for Joe Biden to talk about defense in more explicit ways. I think I agree with Bob. I mean, the administration made the right move in choosing to make a bunch of these cuts. I remember, and Bob probably does too, when the two of us first came into the Congressional Budget Office in the mid-70s, there was a congressman named Joe Addabbo from Long Island, I think he was, and he kept keeping A6s in the budget years after they were supposed to go out. We're going to see a bunch of Joe Addabbos again, but I think, some of these cuts will hold up. The F-15EX makes a lot of sense. Restoring the Aegis destroyer makes a lot of sense. There will be some restoration. Remember, there's no sequester this year, which means that the defense budget top line can go up. It's going to be a function of negotiation. We will see. There are a lot of Democrats who don't particularly want to see the budget go up, and there are a bunch of sort of residual Tea Party types who don't care if the budget doesn't go up. It's going to be an interesting negotiation, but I think the administration's probably correct in saying, look, we just didn't have a lot of time. Mike McCord, who's probably going to be, as Bob knows well, those of us who held that job know we're the ones who have to run to the Hill all the time and kiss rings and make nice. And Mike is only on board now. So, and I'm sure he'll do a great job in doing all of that. But we, you know, the administration needs more people to come on. And as you said, Vago, until they do, it's just that much harder. And the calendar keeps moving along, the clock is ticking. And that's going to make it more complicated and make it easier for those who want to preserve everything at all costs to preserve more than they might otherwise if there was a full team on board.
Let me, Dove, ask you this. Administration, A, right? I mean, there are just not a lot of people manning these jobs, right? So even mundane requests become very hard when you're trying to do the business of running the department, even though there are a lot of very, very talented folks who are filling some of these other lesser political positions. Our system does depend on having senior political people who can make decisions across across the piece. And the opposition is portraying this administration very actively as somehow not focused on war fighting, not focused on defense. Some of these have been self-inflicted gunshot wounds. There was no reason in the world that the first statement from this administration could not have had a line or two on it from a budgetary perspective about national security. Again, plays into tropes and the caricature of it. It is very important for Lloyd Austin to be focused on personnel issues, right? I mean, a big criticism has been from a lot of quarters that defense secretaries don't actually focus on what's important, which is people management issues. You know, Lloyd Austin does that, and it's like, oh my God, that, you know, they're not interested in war fighting. The only thing they want to do is social justice and pregnant women in flight suits. The administration's position is we're not going to stoop to their level and have this tit for tat, which only gives them airtime. But are there messaging things that the administration has just got to be smarter at to not play into, you know, storylines that actually may not be that accurate? Because all I have to say is I'm betting Lloyd Austin works about 100 hours a week. That he spends a couple of hours on personnel matters doesn't mean that he's not spending 6 hours a day on China, right? Or 10 hours a day on China. You know, do you think, Dove, from your perspective, there needs to be a lot more just subtle, basic messaging to not lead people to conclusions that, OK, allies and partners don't matter and that defense is unimportant to this administration?
Yeah, well, obviously, like I said, I mean, one opportunity is the NATO summit. But even with personnel, they could come up with a somewhat different message. I mean, the truth of the matter is that if morale is low and people aren't comfortable because they feel that they're being mistreated in any particular way, you're going to lose wars. I don't care how good your weapons are. And so what Austin could be saying is, look, I care about personnel because I can't win without them. That's not really the way it's been coming across up to now. It's been coming across more as social engineering, which it really isn't. I mean, the truth of the matter is, you know, women do just as well as men, or else they can't get in. And it doesn't really matter what you look like as long as you fight well. And you've got a Secretary of Defense who looks different from his predecessors, and a deputy secretary who's different from her predecessors. It's just that that they need to change the way they're talking about this. They're on the right track, there's no question. But they're actually playing into the, as you say, they're playing into the hands of their critics when they don't need to. And the same goes for working with allies, and the same goes for what they're trying to do with their spending. As I said, I mean, there are certain things that I at least think are puzzling, the S&T budget in particular. Maybe they need to explain that as well. There just needs to be a lot more explanation, a lot more discussion. And again, you know, until you have a full team, it's kind of hard to do that. And maybe that burden just falls on those who are already in place. And it's a heavy burden indeed, but I think they have to take it on.
Or, right, folks like forums like this to try to at least put some of these in context. Go ahead, Bob. Go ahead. Sure.
So I agree with a lot of what Dove said. There'll be more explanation. Obviously, they haven't begun to defend this budget yet. That'll start next week. But part of, some of the problem is the critics. I mean, let's face it, there are some members of Congress who really, I think, don't care so much about the substance so long as they can be critical. And that was true with the Democrats under the Trump administration, but I think it is definitely true for some of the Republicans right now. They're just looking for things that they can use to be critical of this administration. And there's only so much you can do about that. At some point, you can do the best job explaining that you can, and it just may not work with some of these critics.
Byron, and then Patrick, your guys' sense on sort of at least the messaging aspect of all of this?
I don't know. I think it's almost to be determined. You know, let's see how this all plays out. As I said, you know, you're going to start, you've had some appearances before House Armed Services Defense Subcommittee. I'm sorry, the House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee. But, you know, the tone of the questioning, you know, kind of set the agenda. I think it's going to be important, you know, next week, the week after, as we walk through these markups, that's really going to be the prime period to start messaging on some of this stuff. We've heard a lot from service leadership. You know, General McConville has certainly been out and about talking up, you know, think tanks, but I'm not as concerned about messaging in the grand scheme of things. I'm not ready to say that this has been bungled or poorly handled.
Patrick?
Well, Vago, I think everything has been said on that issue. I would add that from China's perspective, when I see Xi Jinping saying he needs to portray a more lovable image of China and maybe tone down the wolf warrior diplomacy, there's a messaging problem. So the United States is doing better, I think, than China at messaging, certainly to the Indo-Pacific, and that's to our advantage. But can we do better? Do we need to do better? Absolutely. I'm sure we will. The pandemic, of course, has been a big issue. And the fact that the political appointment process is so slow is another. But I think we're going to have to do better going forward.
Dov, I'm going to give you the last word. Obviously, a fascinating time in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu's opponents are rejoicing, but Israel's longest-serving prime minister is making clear he's not going anywhere without a hard fight to stay in office, in part because staying in office means he stays out of court and possibly stays out of jail, given he faces serious corruption charges. Can the ultimate odd couple, or I should probably say odd trio, of the ultra-nationalist Naftali Bennett, the centrist Yair Lapid, and the Islamist Ram Party chief Mansour Abbas form a government? And is the Knesset going to deliver a no-confidence vote in Bibi, given that Bibi is spending a lot of time trying to butter up every right-of-center politician to not go along with a new government?
It's obvious that this is such a broad brush government in making that there are certain things they're not going to touch. They're not going to touch the peace process, for example. To get to your question first, and then I'll talk a little bit about what they might do or might not do. There are two Arab groups, really. There's the Ram Party, which is basically signed an agreement. And then there's the old Arab List group. Mm-hmm. And they've announced they're going to support the new government, which makes it a little bit harder for Netanyahu to pull this thing apart. Most people recognize that he wouldn't know the truth if he walked into it. And so whatever he promises, I'm not sure people are going to believe him. And it's going to be much harder, I think, for him to pull enough people away in order to bring this new government down. He's got a track record of lying to his allies, to his friends, to his partners, to just about everybody. And of course, the case of Benny Gantz, who fell for his ploy that, you know, he really thought he was going to take over from Netanyahu, and you saw where that went. I think this government will make it. Now, what will they do once they're in power? They're not going to push the peace process hard. It's too hard because there are people on the right and people on the left in that government. But what they will do, I think, is spend a lot more money on improving the lives of Arab Israelis. They'll probably be much more careful about expropriating Arab properties. They'll probably be contributing in some way to the improvement of the lives of Palestinians on the West Bank and even in Gaza, as long as the money doesn't go to Hamas. And most important of all, they're not going to be partisan. I mean, Netanyahu and his pet boy, the previous ambassador, Ron Dermer, were openly supportive of Republicans. And that doesn't help when you've got the Democrats controlling both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. I think this new government's going to be different. And oh, by the way, people don't realize that the new incoming Prime Minister Bennett speaks English every bit as well as Netanyahu, spent time as a child here, and then came back to the States to make his fortune in New York. So this guy is no stranger to the United States either, and he did not really grow up Orthodox as people think. He actually grew up as something more like the conservative movement, which means he's fully understanding of the fact that most American Jews support a two-state solution. Most American Jews support Democrats. And so I think they're going to lower the partisan tone that's really hurt Israel a lot in Washington and around the country.
Guys, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for this week. Thanks so very much for joining us. Hope everybody has a great weekend and a great week. And looking forward to having you guys back on again next week. Thanks so much.
Thanks as always, Fargo.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks very much, Vago.
And just a note that the National Defense Industrial Association's Emerging Technologies Institute will be hosting a workshop on the modernization quandary on Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern time that will include an august cast of characters, among them General Hawk Carlisle, who is the chief executive officer of NDIA, former deputy acquisition and sustainment under Secretary Al Schaefer, and Dr. Mark Lewis, who is the ETI chief at NDIA. Go to ndia.org to sign up for the conference.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.